Well, hello and welcome back to the Archaeology News Weekly. I'm David Connolly. Sorry I've been away for a wee bit. I'm afraid I did the impossible and went off to Morocco. Anyway, I'm back now. And as you know by now, this news is brought to you in partnership between Stone Pages and the British Archaeological Jobs and Resources website. All the stories have been collected from various sources, and to view details on each story, including the source, go and see the Stone Pages website at news.stonepages.com. So here we have the headlines from around the world. Ancient stone carvings have been found in a forest in South Yorkshire, and a Serbian site may have hosted the first copper makers. Traces of Neolithic civilization, or should we say occupation, are found in India, and a gallery grave in Guernsey yields great Neolithic findings. Artifacts dating back to 5000 BCE are found in Vermont, and Irish police wade through rubbish to save ancient artifacts. We also hear about a lecture telling the life story of an axe, and the secrets of Çatalhöyük are to be revealed this summer. A common ancestor, the search still continues, but we don't have to look too far for an ancient Canadian burial site. And finally, Neolithic Egypt gets its rightful place in a museum. Prehistoric art 3,000 years old was discovered by chance in woodland by a South Yorkshire council worker while carrying out routine maintenance work. John Gilpin, a woodlands officer in the Parks and Countryside Department, stumbled upon the find in Eccleshall Woods, an area of woodland in southwest Sheffield. He discovered a boulder with a series of markings, lines and cuts, which, after being examined by experts, have been declared a significant archaeological find. This is the second example of such rock art from Eccleshall Woods, although other examples are known from the Peak District and further north in the Pennines. The previous discovery of prehistoric rock art in Eccleshall Woods was in 1983. The only other example nearby is at Gardam's Edge, north of Baslow in the Peak District. Well, he's a lucky man. I'll tell you what, I keep looking everywhere for it. I was looking for it in Morocco. I was looking for it up in Kilmartin in Scotland. I look for it in East Lothian. Do I find it? Not a sausage. Of course, if you're interested in finding rock art, then why not actually Google for the Welsh Rock Art Association? They go out and search for rock art, do find rock art, and record it. So it's worth having a little Google on them. The Welsh Rock Art Association. We'll be hearing a bit more about one of them, George Nash, a little bit later on. Now, to Serbia. An archaeological site in Serbia has shown its mettle. The ancient settlement contains the oldest securely dated evidence of copper making from 7,000 years ago, and suggests that copper smelting may have been invented in separate parts of Asia and Europe at that time, rather than spreading from a single source. The find extends the known record of copper smelting by about 500 years. An archaeological team headed by Melania Radivojevic and Thilo Areran of the University College London reports in an upcoming Journal of Archaeological Science. Chemical and microscopic analysis of previously unearthed material from Serbia's Belovode site have identified pieces of copper slag, the residue of an intense heating process used to separate copper from other ore elements. The raw material came from nearby copper ore deposits in Serbia, or perhaps Bulgaria. Our finds here are providing the earliest secured dates for copper smelting and indicate the existence of different, possibly independent centres of and the invention of metallurgy, so says Rehran. Large numbers of copper artefacts have been found at southeastern European sites dating to more than 6,000 years ago. This proposal challenges a long-standing view that copper smelting spread to Europe after originating in or near the Fertile Crescent region of what is now southern Iran. Archaeologists have dated copper smelting in the Middle East to around 6,500 years ago. Although Belovode now stands as the world's oldest known copper smelting site, that status probably won't last long. Archaeologist Benjamin Roberts of the British Museum in London comments, "It's likely we'll see copper smelting evidence at least contemporary with Belovode from the Fertile Crescent once research programmes are in place at well-excavated sites." So he predicts. Roberts believes that copper making was probably invented in one spot, either in Turkey or the Middle East. Rehran's group is now examining possible copper slag sites from Turkey and Iran that date to 7,000 years ago or more. Radiocarbon dates for animal bones excavated at Bellavoda indicate that the site was occupied between 7,350 to 6,650 years ago. Jewellery and other Bellavoda finds came from southeastern Europe's ancient Vinca culture, known for having used copper vessels and other metal items. Chemical analysis of metallic-looking lumps from Bellavoda identified five pieces of copper slag, large amounts of iron, manganese, zinc and cobalt in this material, likely derived from smelted copper ores. Differences in the concentration of elements across samples indicate that each was produced in a separate smelting event. Slag pieces were laced with ash from wood that presumably had been burned to create smelting temperatures of 1,100 degrees Celsius. Lead isotope ratios of the Bellavoda slag and copper drop-link them into ore deposits in Serbia and Bulgaria. No smelting chambers, such as elongated ceramic cylinders recovered at later copper age sites in southwestern Asia, have been found yet. The scientists speculate Vinca residents may have dug pits for copper smelting. Well, who knew that metallurgy could be interesting? But that is a fascinating report, right on the edges of science. The mystery surrounding Khandavid Fort in Andhra Pradesh in India continues to draw countless archaeologists. Now, a freelance archaeologist, K. Venkateswara Rao, has discovered traces for the existence of Neolithic occupation at the fortress, the first of its kind at the site. Mr. Rao, who retired as deputy director in the Sports Authority of Andhra Pradesh, recently discovered a megalithic menhir at Karampudi. He says that cut marks, pieces of pottery and various stones found near two caves on the way to the fort from the western entrance provide solid evidence of Neolithic occupation. The two caves were found on either side of the path, and the cut marks were found on rock boulders near the caves, and they represent the most significant evidence of Neolithic activity. Cut marks are also usually associated with megalithic burial sites. Well, you see, they're going and doing it again. They've managed to find all these fabulous cut marks. In fact, he wasn't even an archaeologist. What was he? Deputy director of a sports authority. Everybody seems to be able to find rock art but me. I'm going to sulk. However, as I said, we were going to be talking about George Nash a little bit later on, and here we are, into Guernsey. A Neolithic burial site in the parish of St. Samson in the island has yielded structures, flint, pottery fragments and stone tools that date back at least 4,500 years. They were discovered in a gallery grave that lies on the coastal fringe of northeastern Guernsey in the Channel Islands. Evidence has also been found of related structures that were previously unknown to archaeologists. The finds were made during a preliminary examination of the site in June 2010. More extensive excavations are due to take place in 2011 that will include further examination around the northern part of the site as well as inside the main gallery. The Delancey Park structure, comprising two lines of stones, extends some 9.5 metres and is Guernsey's only gallery grave. The monument is one of three in the Channel Islands, and a further two stand in neighbouring Jersey, and a further 24 are located in northern France, with two in Wales. Based on the artefacts recovered from the Delancey Park and other gallery graves, these structures appear to date from the late Neolithic period and are therefore later than the passage grave tradition, which more or less dominates the Neolithic monuments of Jersey and Guernsey. Project director, here he is, Dr. George Nash, said, "We found significant archaeology that includes structures that stand away from the main gallery grave. Artifacts recovered from each of the six trenches include 40 or so pieces of worked flint and 38 sherds of late Neolithic early Bronze Age pottery. They've also recovered charcoal samples for radiocarbon dating and ideal pottery samples for thin section analysis." Dr. Nash further explained that the Delancey Park monument survives as two rows of stones that are orientated east-west, similar to other gallery graves in neighbouring Jersey and northern France. Each pair of stones would have supported a capstone, and that the two stone rows and their supported capstones would have formed a gallery, hence the name gallery grave. The inner space sometimes partitioned, possibly each chamber denoting an engendered space, affording separate burial of male and female members of possible social elite. In addition to the fallen uprights of the monument, which was discovered in 1919, the current excavation revealed the stone packing for a series of stone settings that once flanked the main gallery. These clear features once delineated further additions to the gallery and would have provided further mystique to the form and function of the monument. Significantly, between the parallel stone settings of the main gallery was evidence of compacted stone surface, suggesting that the site had initially been prepared for construction of a stone pavement. It's also probable, and based on the loose stones around the site prior, that space between the main gallery and the stone setting was infilled with stone rubble. The history of the site reveals evidence of stone robbing, vandalism and poor archaeological recording. The two investigations from 1919 and 1932 were controversial in as much as no plans were ever made. It was not until 2009 that the first detailed plan of the site was made by the Clifton Antiquarian Club. Based on photographic evidence in 1932, excavation comprised of a dig and pock regime. I'm wondering what exactly that means. Oh, you're going to tell me. The results from both excavations culminated in a small assemblage of bone, stone, pottery artifacts, but it's not clear where these originated. Based upon the rudimentary written records, the most significant object found on the site during the earlier investigations was a possible fragment of a greenstone axe. Guernsey's archaeologist officer, Dr. Philip de Jersey, explained that there was a need to disturb to the late Stone Age site for a third time. He stated that the monument had suffered quite badly, particularly in the early 20th century, and it would be a shame to lose any hope of getting further information out of it. The discoveries made during June 2010 will steer Dr. Nash and his team towards a return visit in 2011 for more extensive research. He said that this would include lifting some of the enormous stones in order to search for further clues beneath, as well as an open excavation directly north of the monument where clear in-situ deposits remain undisturbed. Ancient projectiles dating back roughly 7,000 years ago were found by state archaeologists on land near Thomas's Dairy in Rutland Town, Vermont, USA. John Thomas, unfortunately named John Thomas, one of the landowners, said the pointed projectiles looked like arrowheads and were discovered in at least two different locations on his property. The discovery occurred as part of an archaeological dig by the Vermont Division for Historic Preservation. Scott Dillon, a survey archaeologist, said that 16 projectiles were found at one location and appeared to be intentionally buried together in a pit. The artifacts also included stoneworking tools, fire-cracked rock, and containers for cooking. After the discoveries were made, the state created buffer zones around the sensitive material and put a restriction on the land for anything but agricultural use. Despite the buffer zone determination, four lots on Thomas's property were subdivided, a portion of which will soon be sold to the federal government to build the 70,000 square foot Armed Forces Reserve Center. Regarding the artifacts, Thomas said that although the findings were not a financial burden yet, he feels that they could be in the future. When asked exactly how he felt about the discovery of ancient relics on his land, Thomas answered bluntly, and apologies for the accent, "I feel that if these historic preservation people want to preserve these artifacts, they should put them in a museum and leave me alone." Well, thank you very much, Mr. Thomas. I'll try and do that. Now, to a story that you just cannot make up, we're all heading over to Ireland. Now known as the Cogglebeg Hoard, a collection of gold artifacts dating back 4,000 years were saved from a skip by police in Dublin after being dumped there by pharmacy thieves unaware of their priceless takings. The hoard comprises a gold lunula, which is a crescent-shaped ceremonial ornament, and two small gold discs, both of which date to back to between 2300 and 1800 BCE. Originally discovered in a Cogglebeg bog, the artifacts were kept safe in Sheehan's pharmacy in Strokestown, County Roscommon, since, wait for it, 1947. Burglars had raided the pharmacy safe of the family business, and the Sheehan family notified the police of its contents. Hubert Lannan, who died just 3 weeks earlier, had discovered the items in 1945 when cutting turf on his land, and he then gave them to the local pharmacy for safekeeping. Didn't tell anyone else. The family had vaguely remembered about the pieces stored by their father, who passed away in the 1960s, and also notified the police. It was a race against time to track down the skip before it was towed away. It's a total freak. It almost should never have been found. The Garda, or the Irish police, are the heroes of the whole thing, according to Pat Wallace, director of the National Museum. The finds have been described as the most significant discovery of Irish Bronze Age gold work for quite a long time, and the discs are the first to have been discovered since the 19th century. The Cogglebeg hoard is now on display at the National Museum of Ireland. I have just so many questions about that that I just don't know where to start. But anyway, all works out happily in the end. A hoard discovered back in the 40s, put into a chemist's shop, dumped in a skip, found by the police, is now in the National Museum. So, well done to them. A doctoral study performed at the Centro Nacional de Investigación sobre la Evolución Humana, University of Granada, in Spain, attempted to reconstruct the history of human evolution by performing analysis on teeth from almost all species of hominids that have lived. Going back 4 million years, the morphology of dental fossils from Asia, Africa, and Europe was compared. A statistical analysis was done to determine the probability of correctly assigning each tooth to the species from which it was taken. The results revealed Neanderthal features in ancient European populations, but according to Adia Gomez Robles, the author of the study, none of the samples has a higher probability of 5% that they are a common ancestor of Neanderthals or Homo sapiens. Therefore, the common ancestor of this lineage is likely to have not been discovered yet. This could put the divergence of the two species 500,000 years earlier than previously believed, based upon genetic studies. The analysis techniques used in this study allowed researchers to correctly assign a species to the tooth sample 60 to 80% of the time. If multiple teeth were analysed from the same individual, the success rate rose to 100%. This project employed cutting-edge computer simulations to mathematically model the effect of environmental change on tooth shape. The technique has been used in the past to study other mammals, but never in human evolution. Robles used fossils from sites as diverse as Buryo in Spain and Dmansi in the Republic of Georgia, as well as collections in Paris, Frankfurt, Berlin, Beijing, New York, and Cleveland. The research has been published in the Journal of Human Evolution in 2007 and 2008. Now, a 5-foot man walked the forests of northern Ontario in Canada while the city of Babylon was flourishing and the Great Pyramids were being built. Yeah, a remarkable 4,600-year-old gravesite was revealed when water levels fell in Big Trout Lake. A First Nations fisherman made the discovery. The burial would indicate that the man held some status in his society. The skeleton and nearby sediment are tinted with ochre, and there's a granite slab that seems to be associated with the grave. Dusting bodies with ochre before burial was a common practice in ancient times and is found throughout the world. Life, however, was not easy in this forest environment when temperatures could drop to minus 30 degrees centigrade. And although food was plentiful in spring and summer, the small groups of individuals who would have to travel long distances to find food in winter. Isotope analysis of the bones show that the man's diet consisted mostly of lake fish and some land mammals like caribou. Canadian First Tribes who now inhabit the area retain many of the prehistoric traditions and practices. The ancient ancestor whose remains were uncovered would still recognise the canoes, the snowshoes and clothing in use today. According to Professor Scott Hamilton of Lakehead University Thunder Bay, the past is very recent in the far north. Even the appearance of Europeans in the 17th century did nothing to alter the indigenous way of life, and Hamilton says that many prehistoric traditions are still alive today. The First Nation may be gathering and harvesting resources with European technology, but they're still using a fairly significant amount of traditional technology as well. First Nation Chief Donnie Morris said that the man will be reburied after investigations are complete. The excavation indeed is unusual, as Canadian law normally prohibits archaeological digs at First Nation burial sites. Now, when you think of Egyptian history, the first image is that of a united Egypt under the pharaohs. But a new museum under construction at Gena will house artefacts from the pre-dynastic period, before even the cultures of Upper and Lower Egypt, going back to the first seasonal settlements of approximately 8000 BCE. The site of the new museum overlooks the Nile in an impressive 5 Fidan site, which is approximately 21,000 square metres. It will not only display new finds, but existing ones as well, including the contents of the Mahdi Museum. Mahdi was a little-known site of excavations, which started in 1918. A wealth of information had been published before the sudden end of the excavations by the start of World War II, and this area and its findings remains the most authoritative account of pre-dynastic Egypt. The museum at Kenna will trace the prehistory back to the early settlement in approximately 8000 BCE, examples of which have been found in Fayoum. The settlements comprised mud huts on the shores of what was then a lake, when the level of the Nile was much, much higher. Various pieces of evidence, including sickle flints, suggesting an agricultural society, although it is known that the settlers were semi-nomadic and ventured into the desert to hunt mammals. Evidence of more settled lifestyle has been found at Merinda in the western desert. Radiocarbon dating has confirmed that settlers lived here in approximately 4440 BCE. Remains of insubstantial huts have been found, which were probably used for storage, similar to those found in rural areas of Egypt today. The area around the original dig at Mahdi is under serious threat from urban expansion, so the transfer of the collection to the new museum is very welcome. Mahdi was a perfect location, safe from flooding and with plenty of fresh drinking water. It was, in fact, quite a sophisticated trading centre with excellent links to both Upper and Lower Egypt and a water route to Suez, which spread trading to Palestine and Western Asia. The settlement had an interesting structure. At the heart were houses and huts of various shapes and forms. The core was surrounded by storage facilities, with burial areas located even further from the centre. The subterranean areas proved to be the most interesting, as the construction method of cut and cover was a Palestinian method rather than an Egyptian one, and there are theories that these were the residences of foreign traders, but this is far from being proven. The form and structure of the settlement may not, however, be as clear-cut as just described, and anomalies abound which may, as little remains of the site, remain unresolved. It's hoped that, by bringing together prehistory evidence from various sites, including pottery, flint tools, stone maces, jewellery, combined with modern radiocarbon dating techniques, new light may be shed on this period and its mysteries. It's exciting to note that the Kwena Museum is the only one site in Zahir Wasi's plans to locate specialised museums. Sorry, I'll do that again. I was just Zahir Wasi there. It's exciting to note that the Kwena Museum is only one site in Zahir Wasi's plans to locate specialised museums across the length and breadth of Egypt. Well, one last time, thank you very much for listening to us again here on Archaeology News. I hope you'll return again to us next week, where I promise I will actually be. And if you can't wait until then of course get yourself along to news.stonepages.com and read the latest on the Past Horizons website. Go along to www.pasthorizons.com/magazine. You can, of course, always find more at my own lovely website at Badger, www.bajr.org. If you're on Facebook, then why not find us there? Just search for either Past Horizons or BAJR on Facebook and join us there and keep up to date with our ramblings and our musings. So, with no further ramblings or musings, I thank you for listening to Archaeology News Weekly and look forward to telling you more next week.